Hello, and welcome to the CTED podcast, a podcast focused on the big and small questions of equity and innovation in transportation policy. I'm Dr. James Wood, Program Manager of CTED, that's the Center for Transportation Equity, Decisions, and Dollars. Each episode will focus on a topic within the realm of transportation policy or infrastructure, and we will explore the issues from both an academic and a community or practitioner's perspective. And this week, for our first episode, we'll be discussing cycling for all, ensuring safety, access, and confidence in bicycle planning and infrastructure. With us today is Heather McNair, who is the president of Bike DFW, and that's a nonprofit dedicated to education, rider support, and cycling advocacy in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. Bike DFW conducts classes and workshops for all levels of riders throughout the DFW area, all based around the broader goal of safe and confident cycling. In addition, she is a frequent speaker and advocate on issues relating to cycling, bike ped infrastructure, and the health and environmental benefits of active transportation. She is also a member of CTED's advisory board. Also with us is Dr. Carrie Watkins, who is the Frederick Law Olmsted Associate Professor of Engineering at Georgia Tech. Her expertise centers on multimodal transportation planning, specifically the use of technologies and information to influence traveler behavior and mode choice. She is also a longtime cyclist with a growing interest in rider preferences and decision-making factors at both the rider and infrastructure planning levels. She is also a CTED Assistant Director for Technology Transfer. Heather and Carrie, thank you both for joining us. And to get started, I wanted to ask a general question and let the discussion go from there. So first, how do most Americans learn to ride a bicycle, and how do those experiences shape people's view of cycling over the course of a life? Could we start with Heather, maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me as part of this inaugural broadcast. Generally speaking, for a lot of the population, particularly in the United States, we learn to ride bikes as kids. And I think that then leads to, as we age, for a lot of people, seeing bikes as a toy, sometimes rather than a mode of transportation. Then what we've experienced through our adult learn to ride class is we get a lot of people from other countries where they did not learn to ride as a child. And so as adults, for one reason or another, their kids are getting to the age where they're at an age to start riding, or their grandchildren are getting to that age. They come to us to try to learn how to ride for the first time. In that case, they see it a little differently. It's a connection with family. It's the ability to be do something with their children or their grandchildren. So I think it kind of varies, but particularly in the United States, I think a lot of it is childhood, and thus there's a hard transition to see it as something more than just a toy rather than a mode of transportation.
James, this is not what I do research on, so I'll just talk from personal experience. Heather is more of the expert in this area. But again, as Heather said, thank you so much for having me on your inaugural podcast. What I'll say as a mom, what I've noticed is that the way that I learned to ride a bike as a kid, and most of the people I know who are older than me did, that's not necessarily happening today anymore. And I think that many people of my generation learned to ride as a kid and then moved away from it when they got their license, and then maybe returned at some point because they lived in a place where cycling was a better option for transportation, or, you know, as they aged, they were looking for ways to stay fit that, you know, better suited their lifestyle, and so they moved back into cycling. I think there's some barriers that are occurring now where a lot of kids, because of the way that our streets are designed and the way that traffic volumes have gone up through the years, the fact that, you know, streets are largely not safe for people to be biking on in the way that they were when I was a kid, you don't see kids riding bikes in the same way that we did. When I was of the age that my girls are and younger, that's how I got around, right? It made me less dependent on my parents. I wanted to go see a friend, or, you know, go to some park or run up to the corner store. And I did it by bike, and it made it so that I didn't have to be tied to my parents, and I had a lot more independence at a younger age. And a lot of other countries that we look towards for examples, like the Netherlands and such, or even some cities in the US, like Davis, California, they're designed around the idea of giving kids freedom so that they can have that. And I think that we're missing that now, and that's to our detriment, because as these kids get older, they're going to have to be taking Heather's classes because they'll be first-time cyclists as adults. They won't be returning to cycling. They'll be having to learn it the first time. And that's kind of a scary thought for the future.
And also to think about when you grow up as a cyclist, you know, as a child, as a teenager, you're maybe more aware of safety issues and situational awareness of being a cyclist. But then when you get a driver's license and get a car, at least in a North American context, maybe you start to forget those things and you become less aware of the safety needs of cyclists in terms of visibility or noise or giving them enough space on the roadway. I know when I moved to Texas a few years ago, I was surprised to learn that the state mandates a driver's ed program for young people. Before they can get a license, they have to complete a driver's education course. And that's either through their high school or a private company. They didn't have that in my state. I learned to drive from my parents the way many people do. But I wonder, the way people learn cycling, they learn it often from their children, from their parents, or from older kids that they know. And I wonder, would the lessons stick with them in a different way if it were a more structured program, if they learned it at school, perhaps? And then also at the same time, in parallel to that, maybe driver's ed could be more encompassing of cyclists or sort of sharing the road space. And I wonder if education of, you know, learning how to ride a bike is often informal based on who you know and where you grow up. But I wonder, would a more formal approach improve safety, or what would that look like?
I certainly think it would, particularly if it comes up through the schools as part of education, that there would be a little different perspective on it, if you will. You're absolutely right. Most of the time when we were learning how to ride bikes, it was parents or siblings or friends. And we often see, as an advocacy organization, particularly those folks that don't have the option but to ride a bike to get to work and to get groceries and things like that, will frequently not have ever learned how to do it safely. So they don't have lights on their bike, or they ride against traffic on the sidewalk, and things that actually put them in more danger than if they were actually staying with the flow of traffic and were utilizing side streets to stay, you know, in a safer area, or better yet, had infrastructure protected bike lanes that could give them the opportunity to be able to get from point A to point B safely. I think you're absolutely right. I think having it as part of driver's education would be a minimum, and being able to have a section on that where that's talked about. I'd like to think that we're coming to that point more now than we've ever been before. A lot more people out riding bicycles. One of the things I thought of when Carrie was talking about her daughters and kids of today, I have three young adult children. And what I'm seeing with them and their friends is a number of different reasons, but a lot of them are not getting cars and are not getting driver's license. So there's a real shift happening in this younger generation away from automobiles. We have rideshare now. My kids use the bus system and trains, and they are finding other ways to get around than just having an automobile, because it's so astronomically expensive to own and maintain and cover insurance on an automobile. And a lot of the young people right now don't have that kind of money to be able to do that kind of thing, particularly with housing prices going up. And so suddenly there's a whole new generation here that are looking for alternative modes of transportation that in my generation, you know, it was car. You got your car at 16, you got your permit at 15, you know, that was how you were going to get around. That was how you were going to have independence once you hit the age of being able to do it. So there is a shift happening. So those young people are wanting to live closer into town or closer to their work, so they actually can utilize alternative modes of transportation. So there's an opportunity here, I think, to start to incorporate more education from an earlier age, in light of the fact that this may actually be considered more of a mode of transportation than ever has been before.
Here in Georgia, our similar organizations to the one that Heather works with, we have a state-based and then we have a local Atlanta bike advocacy organization. Our state-based organization is actually taking on a new initiative to look at our driver's training courses. And I've gotten involved in that initiative because I have a 17-year-old and a 15-year-old, which means I've gotten to see firsthand what our driver's training curriculum looks like. And the fact that it's, you know, very much not useful, right? It's not teaching them rules of the road that you really need to know on a day-to-day basis. There's sort of a lot of arcane laws and things like that that are in there because they're just trying to give them a test kind of thing. And so there's a lot of efforts ongoing now by folks in Georgia, at least, to revamp that curriculum and make it so that there are more questions that are about how do you react to this. And some of those clearly should be about cyclists and pedestrians, because this is where we are currently losing people. Injuries and fatalities are actually, for the most part, starting to be addressed, except for those vulnerable road users. And we're seeing injuries and fatalities among those groups continuing to go up year over year. And that's true pretty much everywhere. And that's an issue that has to be addressed. And the only way it's going to be addressed is through better design and, you know, better education in these kinds of realms like driver's training and such. I think the difficulty is the way that we in the U.S. work, where every state does their own thing. So even if Georgia gets it right, it would take a while for, you know, it to be filtered other places. And I know there are states that do a great job with this already that we're looking towards learning from in the state of Georgia.
An interesting component, I read a little bit about bicycle safety and advocacy. I don't work with it full time, but there's certainly a lot to learn and a lot available. And one thing I read that kept coming up, and I know I've spoken to Heather previously about this, is there's a gap, or a gulf rather, a chasm, a big gap between, on the one hand, you have, because bicycle safety or the rules of the road, if you will, are at this point, a lot of it is informal. It's based on what you learn from experience rather than what you learn in a classroom. And over time, you have cyclists, maybe they commute by cycling, where they're fearless. They're accustomed to it because they've ridden everywhere. They're not bothered by traffic or noise or the lack of a bike lane. They're confident cyclists, and good for them. But on the other extreme, you have people who maybe want to bike more. They know it's healthy. They know it's better for the environment, but they're afraid because maybe there's no bike lane, or they're worried about traffic, or it's just overwhelming for some people. And I wonder, I know Heather has some stories from both examples, but Heather, do you know any extremely confident cyclists? And maybe you could talk a bit about their experience.
Yeah, absolutely. So my husband is a full-time commuter, and we live 25 miles from his work, and he does a combination of bike and bus every day except during COVID. and he's done this for 15 years now, and he has always been a utilitarian cyclist, so it's not just going to work. I would say, hey, can you run to the grocery store? And instead of going out to the minivan sitting out in front of the house, he would load up his trailer and take his bike up to the grocery store and get groceries and bring them home. So Michael is definitely a confident cyclist. He rides in, he takes a lane. He dresses in all high vis. We have way more high vis in my house than I ever wanted in my life. Has tons of lights on his bike. He is a confident and careful cyclist, but he doesn't think about it in terms of how I would feel as not such a confident cyclist going out on the same roads. And he rides on relatively busy roads some of the time. And so one of the things, it's kind of good to have that in the same house with me over here going, okay, I'm not that confident, because A, it makes him as an instructor, he's a cycling instructor, recognize that just because this feels comfortable for him, it doesn't mean it feels comfortable for everybody else. And what I always tell people is, I want you to think about, would you feel safe with your child on a bike behind you when you ride on this road? And if the answer is no, then it's not safe enough and it's not where it needs to be. There is a phrase, 8 to 80, that's talked about. I can't remember if it's an AARP phrase that's used, but it's the idea being is that we want infrastructure that serves the needs of everyone from age 8 to age 80. And if it's not in that realm, then it's not really meeting the needs of the population. For a long time, there was a very strong movement towards cyclists being vehicles and taking lane, and that was how it needed to be, and we didn't need bike infrastructure and this kind of thing. And what that did is it very much funneled a very certain type of person into cycling for the most part. And that was male. And it was, they call them mammals, middle-aged men in Lycra. But it was the mostly male, brave, maybe a little too brave, going out and doing it. And it was really excluding a whole population of females and children and older people. There's been such a shift over the last couple of years. It's been really incredible to watch. And who would have thought that COVID would have, on the positive side, the few that we can find, absolutely has changed the landscape that we have the potential to continue forward from here. And so many more people getting out on bikes, e-bikes coming into popularity, which opens up the door to people with disabilities, to older people. There is this number, again, young people not necessarily getting cars and wanting to be able to ride. We've got this sort of perfect storm right now of, in a positive way, of a lot of reasons to think that there's going to be a shift, and there is a shift happening to where this is a much more inclusive and a much more expansive group of people that we are needing to meet the needs of and where our infrastructure is going. So that 8 to 80 is a good rule of thumb. If it's not there, then we need to work on it some more and try to not only build it, but make the connections that need to be made to utilize the trail systems and the other amenities that we already have. But we need to make those connections so that everybody has the opportunity to be able to ride safely and feel confident in what they're doing.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Heather, the 8 to 80 piece, the way that a lot of the cities and regions and advocacy organizations that I've worked with have thought about it is, you know, when you are thinking about cycling, that's one thing. Think about, you know, your kid, like you said, and also your mother, right? Like, how would you want the infrastructure to be designed if you, spandex clad person who's, you know, we call them strong and fearless often. There's this popular rhetoric around these multiple categories. And, you know, even if you're one of those strong and fearless cyclists, how would you feel if your kid was in front of you on their own bike and your mom was behind you on her own? What would you want that infrastructure to look like? And it's a very different picture. And Heather's right that we have this history in the U.S. of where we pushed away from dedicated bike infrastructure and we pushed towards riding on the road. And it was really the idea that either you can handle this or you shouldn't be on a bike. And that made it so that only 1% of the population bikes, because about 1% of the population falls into this strong and fearless category. We think there's this next category down that's a little bit more timid, but, you know, still pretty confident. And we think that is sort of the next, you know, 5 to 10% of the population. And so when you get cities like Portland or Minneapolis, where they're starting to design with more bike lanes, some facilities, you're getting that percentage of the population. Now, to get to Davis, California numbers or Dutch numbers in places like that, we really need this very high level of infrastructure. And this is what we're starting to get to in a lot of cities in the U.S. now, where it's these, we call them cycle tracks or separated or protected bicycle lanes where there's parking or barriers or something in between the moving vehicles and the cyclists if it's a roadway that's faster than about 25 miles an hour. And the thing is, on slower roads, we can design, and everybody feels comfortable. Your local road, where it's a lot of residential housing, you know, these are the kinds of places where everybody can mix, and you know, you feel comfortable riding with your kid on your bike and on their bike next to you. And these are the places we still teach kids to bike. But we've got pockets of development that have that, and then you've got these more major roads that are getting faster and faster with more and more distracted drivers, and it's just not safe, and it doesn't feel safe for anybody who's not in that strong and fearless category to be biking on those kinds of roads. And so moving towards, all right, we need a full bike network where these local facilities that are slower with really low volumes are then connected via, you know, these more major roads where we've built separated infrastructure that all ages and abilities can feel safe using. And then, you know, you can actually get fully from your origin to your destination, and you're not going to, you know, get stuck someplace where you don't feel comfortable and you end up riding on a sidewalk because you don't feel like you belong in the road. And so I think Heather hit the nail on the head with many of those points about sort of, I also have a strong and fearless husband cyclist, and I am much more timid, and often you sort of see these gender splits. But that's not to say that even those folks who are spandex clad, many, many of them prefer this more dedicated infrastructure as well. It just has to be built right so that they can still maintain decent speeds on it. And it really depends on the kind of cycling they're doing. Some of those kinds of folks will still be in the lane on a Sunday when they're out for a leisure ride. But when they're wearing their suit to get to work, they'd rather go a little bit slower and be in protected bike infrastructure as well. So when we do surveys asking people about these things, you sort of see the gamut. And there's actually support even among folks in a lot of those sort of more fearless groups to have these higher levels of infrastructure so that everyone can feel safe.
We're all in what maybe used to be called Sunbelt cities. Atlanta, which is a large southeastern auto-dominant city, and the Dallas-Fort Worth area, which is also in the south. It's auto-dominated. It just sort of goes on forever. And I know when I talk to people on the college campus or nearby about why they don't do more cycling or why cycling doesn't really go beyond that 1% of fearless riders, and I'm sure the two of you would have a much more nuanced view, but it generally boils down to either the climate, that it's too hot to cycle for much of the year or too humid, or failing that, it's the culture or the political climate, where I had an office mate who didn't drive. He couldn't drive. He rode his bicycle everywhere. And when he would ride his bicycle around just our little suburb within DFW, he said drivers were hostile to him and would throw things and honk. And he felt unsafe even before he would get on the bicycle. There were certain roads he would just avoid because culturally, drivers are not only, they're not aware of cyclists, they're sometimes hostile to cyclists. In thinking about, you know, from a planning perspective or a governance perspective, we can't do much about the climate. It's hot in Atlanta and in Dallas in the summertime. But what could we do or what should local practitioners maybe be doing to think about those cultural issues? And maybe we could start with Heather. I know you've met with a lot of local officials over the years.
Let me jump in first for a second before Heather addresses some of the cultural aspects, and I'm sure she has a ton to say about that. Let me address the climate piece first, though, because, and maybe she was about to do this too, I don't want to dismiss that out of hand, because I think part of it is that when you are riding in the road with vehicles, and we actually have research to back this up, you feel like you have to go fast, right? You have to work hard. Even if it's July and it's 95 degrees and 100% humidity, you feel like you have to, you know, be pedaling your legs off to keep up with these cars that you're surrounded by. And when we move away from that kind of infrastructure and we actually start to design for cyclists, they can go at the speed that they want, and that becomes more comfortable, even in that summertime riding. So I don't want to dismiss that piece out of hand, but I'll let Heather talk about some of the cultural pieces, because I'm excited to hear what she might say.
I think the climate thing is, my husband always says he just has a built-in air conditioner because he's moving. And so he's got the air flowing across to me. So he loves, his favorite time to ride is in the heat of summer. I don't understand that, but that is definitely when he likes to ride. And again, if you're doing it on a regular basis too, you're in better shape. You're not pushing as hard. You can, and again, like Carrie mentioned, when there's infrastructure in place, you don't have to try to keep up with the vehicles around you, which you're never going to do anyway. But you can relax a bit more if you have your suit on or you have your dress clothes on, you can find a way to do it. And then there's all kinds of little tips and tricks to cleaning up once you get to work or you get where you're going. The one other thing I want to say on that really quickly, just so I don't forget, is that commuting by bike doesn't mean you have to do it every single day. If you commute by bike once a week, you're still having an impact. And what we frequently see is somebody starts off with once a week, maybe combination bus and bike, which is totally cool. Multimodal is awesome. But they start off once a week and they get the bug, and then it's twice a week, and then it's three times a week. Some people think it's like all or nothing. Either you're commuting by bike or you're in a car. And the reality is you can do a combination and still have an impact, not only on your physical self, but on the environment and everything else. So so the cultural aspect of it, yeah, this is such a challenging thing. I remember when the Dockless Bike Share came to Dallas 2018, we ended up with 20,000 Dockless bikes in primarily our downtown Dallas area. And it was a controversial time, you know. It was great to see a lot of people. There was a lot of people using them. There was some data that we were able to get from it that actually showed the city that actually, if it was available, there was a lot of people that would ride. It also showed how very weak our infrastructure system was. But there was a lot of debate, a lot of people, cyclists and non-cyclists, that hated the bike shares. And I had a couple opportunities where I was speaking, and always kind of the first question that somebody would ask is, so what does Bike DFW think about the Dockless Bike Share? And as I would tell them, you know, we support alternative modes of transportation. So in light of that, we were in support of bike share. It's an awesome way to have something like that as an alternative mode of transportation. So, but on a personal level, it meant whether you hated them being there or you loved them being there, you were thinking about bikes, which meant my husband was safer on his ride to work than he had been before bike share came. As drivers, we get used to looking for other cars. So when we pull up to an intersection and we look both ways, it is remarkable how well our brain can shut off all the peripheral stuff that's going on, even sometimes to the point of not seeing a pedestrian or not seeing a cyclist. And so even if somebody was heated up and really mad about the bike share, at least they were thinking about bikes, which meant automatically brain was going to notice those kinds of things. My husband has been commuting for a long time, and he's had certainly a ton of experiences, far more than I would have liked, with people that threw things at him or yelled things at him, who were not happy about him being on the road, even if there was plenty of space for them to be there. But the one thing that we noticed was, early on when he was doing it, he was riding up, he was primarily on a singular road all the way for about 20 miles, but it was a 6-lane road, and he was on there every day at the same time. And the first week that he was riding it, he had people honking, riding up, you know, a little too close behind, so forth and so on. But by the second week, they would honk the horn and wave at him. There was a shift that was happening that we could have never anticipated, from this is this obstacle and this impediment to, he wasn't a human being. He was an impediment to the driver getting where they needed to go, until he became a commuter like them. And then he was somebody that they saw every single day, every single morning. And so if he stopped at a gas station or something, invariably there'd be somebody to go, you're that guy that's on the bike. You know, how far are you going? What do you do? And he became human. And so I think what has happened, we get into our metal boxes and everything outside of our metal box sort of becomes dehumanized. And so that person on a bike is not a person on a bike. They are an obstacle. They're an impediment. They're slowing us down. Instead of that's a father or a husband or a brother or a sister or a mom. And that is sort of the culture shift that has to start changing. Social rides have become very popular in Dallas. And it's such an awesome way for the average person to get out and ride on the roads in a group and have sort of that protection of other people around, but also the example of how to get around using the roads. And because it's a group, it's less likely to get a whole lot of negative interaction with drivers for the most part. These are usually smaller groups, you know, 10, 12 people or so. But it is by people seeing more people out riding bikes, seeing them taking the same pathways that we take, it does start to shift how people on bikes are looked at. And so then it's just a matter of time and continuing to make sure that we facilitate people being able to get out and ride. Bike lanes in and of themselves, obviously even a protected bike lane is not going to save you from a car coming through it and hitting you. What actually makes us safer in those situations is more people riding. So the more people that are out on the streets, the safer everybody is, because again, then drivers are reminded, hey, there's people out here riding with us. So I hope I was able to sort of circle that completely around from where I started with that. But that is, the culture is changing and it is shifting. And I'm seeing it in so many different ways, just in the matter of the last 4 to 5 years, that I do see a future. And a lot of people think Dallas, that, you know, you guys are so not bike friendly. I mean, I've had this conversation with more people than I care to say. And yet, both personally and as an organization, what we have seen is that we have an incredible bike community. When somebody needs something, there is somebody there. When there is a fight to fight, you know, a need to go out and advocate for something that makes it better for cyclists and pedestrians in Dallas and Fort Worth, that there is a huge community. They're strong, they're passionate. And that is what's going to start to shift, continue to shift the culture around bicycling.
I just want to add in, James, that what Heather's talking about, this concept of the more people doing it, we call it safety in numbers. And there's actually lots of academic study to back up this concept that you do get used to seeing more pedestrians, more cyclists. And as you do so, we see crash rates going down. So in the communities where people bike more, you may see more crashes because there are more miles happening, but on a per person, per mile basis, those rates start to go down dramatically. And that's kind of where we have to get to in the South. I guess I don't know if Texas can be included as the South, but I am clearly smack in the middle of the South. And these cultures are absolutely, you know, something that makes it difficult because people's reaction is going to be different to you than when I used to cycle in Seattle. And part of it is, you know, an attitude, not just that they're not seeing you, but they are seeing you and they're yelling at you. And, you know, it's just a different culture. And I think that's something that has to be worked on too. That's, you know, a big part of encouraging people to be willing to get out there on a bike is, you know, do you want to live in the kind of community where people bike or where people are afraid to bike? And I hope, you know, hopefully most people would answer that question in a certain direction that you know, we can all benefit from, whether you're on the bike or not.
This leads into one topic that it's been difficult for me to just look into as a host preparation, but also as a scholar of transportation. You know, CTED has its explicit focus on equity. And what that means to us is that people should have equal and open access to the things that make their lives complete. They should have access to jobs, to cultural enrichment, to transportation systems, certainly. I know within the DFW area, within other cities, a lot of the activism and infrastructure that's being put in, maybe a lot of it's being led from suburban areas or from certain neighborhoods, but not other neighborhoods. And maybe there are there neighborhoods within major cities, like I think of South Dallas or Southern San Francisco, places that are maybe being left out or where the, you know, maybe they're lower income populations where they could certainly benefit from having cheap, reliable transportation. But does cycling appeal to all groups of people, or could advocates be doing more to address vulnerable populations, immigrant populations, low-income families? And I wonder, how does the messaging work in those neighborhoods?
We have a awesome group. Bike Friendly South Dallas is one of our bike friendly groups in the Dallas area, and their specific focus is on Southern Dallas. And it is a process to, again, women weren't all that involved with cycling 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And so lower income, the reality is there are actually a lot of lower income people that are riding a bike, but who are doing it out of necessity without training, without the education to be able to do it as safely as possible, without the means to be able to do it as safely as possible. We started a program through Bike DFW last year, 2019. Last year was 2020. In 2019, called Light It Up. And the idea was that we knew from talking to the community how often they were seeing people out riding bikes without lights at night. And oftentimes when we've had accidents where cyclists have been hit, it's been somebody going to or from work at night as their main mode of transportation without lights. And so all the things that we talk about for safety purposes, wearing a helmet, having lights on your bike, wearing high-vis or at least light-colored clothing, all of those things, we have to be careful not to become conditioned to the idea that everybody has that information accessible to them. So we started the Light It Up program. And the idea was that we would, there's so many social rides around the Dallas-Fort Worth area that we as an organization would purchase the lights. And these are just little silicone, so there's no tools involved. They're not, the white light's not going to light your way where you're going, but it's going to make you visible. And then a rear red light. And that we would go to these social rides and give them to the cyclist, who most had their own lights. But what we would say to them is, if you need a set, take a set, and then take another set, give it out to somebody that you see out riding that doesn't have lights on their bike, and tell them to look up Bike DFW. And if they didn't need a set, take two sets and go find two people that need lights out there. And we kind of started off, there's other organizations that do it across the country in a little different ways. Sometimes they have a specific ride that they go out themselves and distribute lights and that kind of thing. But the cool thing about this is that it sort of, we would go to like Dallas Critical Mass and hand out 100 sets of lights. And then those would get dispersed all over the region. And we would get stories back of people going, hey, I was out riding the other night. I saw a young man riding without lights. I was able to go over and say, hey, I have a set of lights for you. Get them hooked up with them. Told them to look at Bike DFW. And it was awesome. I need more because I want to be able to give out more. And so it was this awesome way to incorporate some giving back to the community, even with the social rides, where normally it's just going out and getting beers or going to tacos or whatever the case may be. This actually gave them something to do while they were out doing that. And it also made them feel good because they actually had this opportunity to help somebody that might not have that information. Again, it's these little steps. Bike Friendly South Dallas got a grant from AARP this year in 2020 to put out repair stations. And so they're partnering with different churches, recreation centers, other types of community organizations to put these repair stations, which has a pump and the basic tools you might need to do some repairs on your bike. And so then they're partnering with these organizations to make sure that there's some buy-in from the neighborhood and being able to show people how to use these repair stations. And because what we hear often is both kids and adults, oh, I have a bike at home, but I don't know how to pump up the tires, or I don't know how to change the tire, or some really generally basic repair thing is keeping them from being able to ride the bike. Bike Friendly South Dallas started out doing pop-up bike shops all over South Dallas area. So they would go out with their tools to different neighborhoods and set up, and then kids would bring their bikes that they had sitting in the backyard that they weren't able to use. They could get them up and riding again, give them a helmet, talk to them about safety. And those are those little pieces that start to make that difference. There's a group in Fort Worth called the Bike Gangs of Fort Worth. And it started off as just a neighborhood group. And basically it was just a, hey, my kids want to go out and ride their bike. Anybody in the neighborhood that wants to join us, come over and join us. We'll ride to the park and then we'll ride, have snacks, and then we'll ride back again. And what they found is that some of the kids didn't have bikes. And so they started taking donations, or they'd scan Craigslist, you know, and get any of the bikes that they could get fixed up. And so it's these little pieces that start to pull in all the different socioeconomic areas, you know, that are different in at least the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So I think that has a lot to offer, as well as, interestingly enough, doing our classes virtually, doing our meetings virtually, has opened up the door to some people, some folks that might not have been able to come to our meetings before when we were doing them in person. And so that's another way that we can start to address the equity issue.
In Atlanta, we have a lot of similar programs in trying to make sure that people have a bike and things that they need. I think there's some other important points to bring up when it relates to equity, though. One thing on the academic side of things is we don't actually have a good idea of who cyclists actually are, right? There's not a lot of data, period, about how many cyclists are out there and what these cyclists actually look like. And a lot of times the way that we get data to do decisions, we're missing large groups of people. I used to run an app called Cycle Atlanta, where we were having people download this app and, you know, on their smartphones, and they were recording their trips. Well, the thing is, if you don't have a smartphone, you can't do it. If you have a smartphone, but you don't have a data plan, you can't do it because you had to be like pinpointing your points as you were traveling. And so you're missing this whole group of people. We did all this outreach to try to make sure that we were getting people recording trips from across Atlanta, but that's just going to be missing from that stream of data. And when you use apps like Strava and things like that, that aren't even representative of a wide cross-section of wealthier cyclists, it's really only those sports cyclists who are in those kinds of apps. If you're making decisions based on that kind of data, that could be even more dangerous. And so I think one of the big equity points that we need to work on is having a better understanding of where these cyclists are and where people are who want to be biking but don't feel like they can. And like Heather's talking about, a lot of that comes down to this constant struggle. This is, you know, there are a lot of parts of COVID that have made cycling better. We're seeing more people who have means to be out there biking more. But at the same time, the economic impacts of COVID make it so that there are more and more people who may need to be cycling, if not now, in the near future, because they don't have the economic means to afford an automobile, like Heather was talking about. And making it so that they can make the decision that I'm going to get around on bikes so that I can free up some of my income for other purposes, like that could really help certain demographic groups. The other part that I want to bring up, though, is in the cycling community, we worry about the lack of safety on roads, and we try to figure out how to better design for that. One of the ways that we've long filled in the gaps until we can design better is through enforcement. But there's this growing movement of folks who are trying to help people understand that if you are a cyclist of color, oftentimes you are picked out in ways that other cyclists would not be. And we have to make sure that as we move towards, you know, as we use enforcement to make it safer for you know, everyone in the community, that we have to make sure that we're doing this in equitable ways and that we're ensuring that we're not specifically picking out neighborhoods or people and disproportionately enforcing rules for drivers, for cyclists, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a big part of making sure this whole system is equitable as well. And I'm sure Heather and I could go into a whole host of other things on, you know, making sure that we're designing for people who have some sort of disabilities. There's a lot of cyclists out there who actually use tricycles. I have a very good friend who has just one arm and is an avid cyclist. And making sure that we design infrastructure so that those folks can still be out there as well. There's a long way to go. CTED has lots of work ahead of it, lots of potential projects in the future.
Yeah, and I was going to just add really quickly, that's one of the things that we've actually really kind of started calling them mobility lanes rather than bike lanes even. Yep. There's a couple different reasons for that. One is, what I found is when you say bike lane, there's a certain segment of the population that kind of shuts down and really can't hear anything that you say beyond the first time you say bike lane. Whereas when you say mobility lane, it at least makes them stop and go, wait, what's a mobility lane? The other thing is I have a daughter that's in a power wheelchair. And obviously scooters have become, the power scooters have become, and the scooter share has become a big part of everywhere pretty much as another alternative mode of transportation. So when we talk about this infrastructure, we're not just talking about for bikes. It really can be a mode. There's lots of places in the Dallas-Fort Worth region that don't have sidewalks. So for my daughter to be able to go out in her power wheelchair, and if there's infrastructure that she can use where she's not having to ride in the road, that would be awesome for her too. So it touches more. It was very interesting. I was on an advisory committee, and some of the other advisors work with the elderly in Dallas. And when we started talking about bike lanes and mobility infrastructure, they were like, this really has nothing to do with us. And, you know, this isn't helping our constituents that we're here to represent. And so it gave us an opportunity to talk about how it actually, not only from the perspective of them potentially being able to use that bike lane or the mobility lane, but for example, on a road that has bike lanes on each side and then sidewalks, it actually gives an additional buffer between somebody walking and the traffic that's out there. And so there's all these different things that it's a traffic calming measure. So it slows cars down. So that in and of itself is going to improve it for both those that are walking and those that are riding at the same time. So there is that part of equity also of making sure that we're not just doing able-bodied, but, you know, how are we making sure that we're meeting the needs of people that are in recumbent bikes? You know, sometimes they'll have a crossing that will go over and there'll be like a pole right in the middle, which can be really challenging for somebody that's in a recumbent bike to be able to get around and continue on the trail. So yes, definitely some other things, but I loved what Carrie had to say about this also.
And I think that was one of my questions to work with this is in looking at bicycle planning in cities that, you know, when it has been formalized, people have been riding bicycles obviously for well over a century, but for US cities to begin sitting down and putting out actual structured plans for bicycle infrastructure and asking advocacy groups or asking academics where to put the bike lanes or even to call them bike lanes, mobility lanes, or how to do this. I don't know much about them myself, but I wonder, are they capturing the right information? Are they doing as well as they could? Do you think there are lessons? Because our audience may be made up of practitioners who do this for a living. Are there things that they're not hearing that they should be listening to in terms of the infrastructure choice, the infrastructure funding, and also the educational component?
I mean, I would say to a certain extent, yes. Let me answer this question in two ways. First, what I would say is that we have to have a network approach to all of these things. And so, you know, where to put the infrastructure. You put the infrastructure to fill in the gaps to make sure that there are safe ways to get around from every, you know, origin to every destination, right? And then over time, you try to fill in those gaps even more. So let's create a network where, you know, nobody has to go too far out of their way to have safe bike infrastructure. And then over time, let's get it to the point where, you know, almost every road, you know, that there are certain roads that are high speed facilities we've designated. And other than those, every road is considered, you know, bike and pedestrian friendly. But we have to get there, right? And so at some point, we have to prioritize, like, which one's going to come first? And I don't think anybody in the Heather and I's community thinks that these are easy decisions to be made. What I'll say is that, you know, there's lots of academic literature about here's how we should prioritize and whatnot, different schemes for doing this, and what kind of infrastructure versus where it goes, and lots of different metrics that we would use, level of traffic stress or things like that, that exist at a network level where we can actually look at, you know, here's this pocket that is, you know, easily within it you can bike, and here's this other pocket that easily within it you can, but they're disconnected from each other. And so, you know, the network you can get to is only limited to this one, because anybody who's slightly more timid is not going to be able to leave this little pocket. And there's lots of metrics that will look at those kinds of things. But what I'll say is that I think a big part of it, and this maybe relates back to the equity piece, is I've noticed some, like our local advocacy organization in Atlanta, the Atlanta Bike Coalition, they've started to come into communities and ask first, you know, what are your transportation needs? What are you most worried about? And instead of, like Heather's saying, instead of being about bikes, they're about how do we make safe, equitable transportation options? And so at the same time, they're helping to advocate for access to transit, and to advocate for safe pedestrian facilities, at the same time that they're trying to incorporate some of the bike facilities in there in the communities where folks want to see this. And they're specifically doing this in communities that have largely not had a voice for years and years, because there are communities out there where people are going to be heard. They want to be heard. And so they beat on the city's door. And there are other communities where people are working two jobs and, you know, whatever like that, and they don't have time to be beating on. They don't even know who the city person is that they should be beating on the door of in order to get these things done. And so I've been really proud of how we, it's ABC is their acronym, has come into these communities to try to simultaneously advocate for just safe, equitable transportation, period. Because there's lots of ways that we do that. And not to incite a war on cars, but having options where, you know, we're advocating for all of these different modes that are not vehicle-centric, because that's where we've been in the U.S. is being vehicle-centric, but simultaneously advocating for all of these things that are not cars at the same time in the way that the community is making it heard that they want to see it happen. That's going to be the best path to success, right? You're going to solve problems. People are going to help get, you know, instead of fighting you when you want to put some infrastructure in. And so in my mind, that's kind of how you go about it. Like, it's not necessarily about deciding, like, we may prioritize, here's where the most crashes are happening. Here's where the most cyclists are. Here's the gaps that are going to make our network not work well. We got to know where all that is. We got to have our data and our maps and things like that. But at the same time, we got to come in and work with those communities to have this stuff built, and even identify other problems that we haven't seen pop up just through the data.
Yes, yes, yes. All of that and more. I think it's that the technical aspects coming together with real life, and what is technically the way things should go from a network perspective, and connectivity is absolutely critical, and thankfully seems to be something that the cities and counties are understanding now, that it's not just about putting infrastructure somewhere to say we put in a 2 mile stretch or 1 mile stretch, but that if it's not connecting to anything, then it's not going to be used. And then everybody goes, see, we said nobody was going to use that bike lane. Well, it doesn't go anywhere, or it dead ends and sort of spits cyclists out into a dangerous intersection that they now have to figure out where they're going to go from there. So one of the things, so in a typical year, Bike DFW sets up at about 75 events. And while some of those are bike oriented, a lot of them are just community oriented events. And what's cool about that is it means that while we, you know, at the bike oriented events, we're talking to a lot of cyclists and there's that camaraderie and that kind of thing. At these community events, we're talking to a lot of people that go, you know, we have bikes at home, but we're not quite sure how to get started. And so then that opens up the door to being able to get them their information and the resources and the education and the connections that they need to be able to do that. And so I think as Carrie was talking about going into the community, into all of the communities and being able to say, what are your needs? And also keeping in mind, you know, we're running into the sort of the same thing. We're not just about bicycles anymore. It is a much broader ranged thing. It's pedestrians, it's bicycles, it's scooters, it's multimodal, it's, you know, public transportation. These things all connect together and in the perfect world, these are all connected together. So that we have a spot in Dallas that we've got a beautiful trail that's been put in. We have a DART station. We have no connection. And it's like a block. But there's no connection between the trail and the DART station. And if you're going to come up off the trail to get to the DART station, you're going to be in a 6-lane road. And there's people walking in the 6-lane road because there's no sidewalk even. And so it's finding those little pieces, those that low hanging fruit. It's signage. It's, you know, directional signage of, you know, you're coming to an end of a trail and here's how you can get to the next trail in the safest way possible. And we have tons of trails in Dallas-Fort Worth area. Super excited. The North Central Texas Council of Governments and all the cities and county and everything else have worked together. And we're going to have this trail that's going to go from Dallas to Fort Worth. And that's super exciting. But the reality is you're not using the bike as a mode of transportation. You can exercise and you can enjoy yourself doing that kind of thing. But we still have to reach the people that are using it to get to the bus stop or get to the grocery store or get to work and don't have another option or simply choose not to have another option, and making sure that those voices are heard. And like Carrie talked about, the people that end up being silent are the ones that are working two jobs and don't have the ability and don't know how to make those connections. And so these community events, it's an awesome way to have these conversations with people that otherwise are not getting a chance to voice their needs and where they're looking for transportation related infrastructure that helps them get from point A to point B.
Just a really fascinating aspect of this from my perspective as sort of an observer is the fact that so much of the energy and expertise and the passion on these issues, so much of the movement on these issues has come from ordinary people and organizations and grassroots. Among urban planners are in general somewhat of a technocratic and a progressive group. They're willing to often try new transportation, but it's very rare to meet an urban planner who gets a lot of formal training in bike ped planning. In most departments, there's maybe one course or maybe two, if you're lucky, on bike ped planning. And very few of us end up working full time as bike ped planners. So the drive, the motivation comes from people who ride bikes themselves or who are married to someone who rides a cycle. And on the one hand, that's interesting. I did my dissertation on older adult transportation, and I found something very similar, that most of the energy in advocacy for older people comes from these nonprofits rather than from the government, which that's interesting and it's heartwarming that so many people care and are willing to volunteer their time. But at the same time, it exposes kind of a shortcoming in translating passion into action, because there's only so much a citizen group can do without those tools or the access to levers of power. And you have to hope that you get a city commissioner or a county commissioner who listens to you, but you may not have that. Dallas, I know at least the city of Dallas has a few people who are really passionate cyclists in their city leadership, but in other places, it might be a really uphill climb to get the policymakers to spend money, or the governor or the president to take this seriously, because the money is really what's needed as much as the passion.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I was, and I apologize if I interrupted you, but it was very interesting. So Dallas is coming up with their mobility plan for, I think it's the next 25 years or something like that. And I was on that advisory board, and there was a whole, you know, public survey comment period and all this kind of thing. And what it really ended up being is it showed how much less expensive it was to put in good infrastructure for bicycles, pedestrians, and public transportation over adding more lanes to highways and things like that, which is what we've traditionally, the route that was gone down. And so in light of that, what we're seeing is, yes, right now, Dallas City Council is predominantly in favor of bicycle infrastructure, but this is new. I have advocate friends that I got lucky. I kind of came in on the beginning of when all these shifts were starting to happen. And so it's been able to keep my energy up and our momentum going and everything like that. But I have advocate friends that have been in Dallas and advocating for 20 years, and just how slow and tedious and frustrating the process has been. But I do think city governments are starting to recognize this need, and particularly as the pedestrian and cyclist fatalities continue to rise, there's a safety component, a quality of life component that's coming in. We have so many people, and I think Atlanta is the same way. There's so many people moving in from other places where cycling is more prevalent and there is more infrastructure. And they're coming here, and this becomes a quality of life, you know, from an economic standpoint. If you're going to attract, some of these larger companies, part of what attracts them is the amenities that they have for their employees, and so it's an interesting time of seeing what once was sort of the bane of any political person's existence. There's bike people, has now shifted because they actually can see, because of data from studies that have been done and things like that, that there is an economic impact, positive economic impact, that there's a health impact, that there's the environmental impact, there's the equity impact, that there's, it really, when cities are looking at sort of their primary principles, their primary values in the city, cycling starts to suddenly fit into all of those in some way and improving that aspect of things. So it is really fascinating to watch, but it's so early in this transition. I hope that as we move forward, that there will be more focus on that in these urban planning programs, just because it is becoming something that's being far more accepted and recognized as being an important part of that process. That the quality of life is being considered in that.
I'll add in from the original question, James, that shame on them for not including in the curriculum in both planning and civil engineering programs more about multimodality, right? Even if this is not something that you were formally taught, there's great materials out there now. If there's any educators listening to this, they can get in touch with me, but they can also go to the Ped Bike Information Center, and they have materials. FHWA has sponsored projects to put together university materials where there are course modules up there, and anybody who's teaching in civil engineering, city planning, anything related, a policy program, they have modules that can easily slip into even a broader course on multimodality or sustainability or anything, just your intro to transportation or your base level transportation planning course. It's time for more people to be educated in how to design, plan, maintain these facilities better so that we can make sure that this is actually happening. And then to go on from what Heather was saying, and it's our job to educate those politicians, right? Every politician has transportation staff that they look towards. And so we as educators, the group I represent on this call, have to make sure that we're teaching our students well so that they can go be that transportation policy advisor for all those levels of government to make sure that we are making the right decisions.
Yes, and it makes me think, when I was in graduate school, like, I don't want to say which state it was in, but I took a course on demand modeling, which many urban planners take that course. It's a lot of math, and it's, I hated the course, but some people like it. But we were taught by a state DOT employee, and he had really good expertise in designing demand models and computer models for how much traffic flows in and out of a given area and how to plan the road infrastructure for traffic. And we would have a series of exercises about, you know, suppose you're an urban planner and you have to approve a subdivision development. And this is how much traffic it's going to generate and put cars on the road and children in schools and people in supermarkets, all these different measures of growth in a community. And I remember there was a line for underneath cars, there was a line for how many pedestrians and a line for how many cyclists. And we had a very detailed four-step, you know, generation model to figure out how many cars were coming and going. But for pedestrians and bicyclists, the instructor just sort of skipped over it and said, that's negligible. No one's going to walk. No one's going to ride a bike. So you don't have to even think about counting them. And we knew that was a little bit nonsense, that it was like a privilege checking moment where we had wished that maybe he would step outside his traditional thinking, but we didn't have much luck persuading him in the course. But I think that is part of it. And it's that little turn of phrase, that little microscopic moment where the instructor or someone in a position of influence simply says, don't even bother thinking about it. That we assume it's such a small number, it's only 1% or 2% of the community. So therefore, there's not enough of them to maybe make a difference. Or even if you don't plan it well, they won't knock on your door and cause you trouble in your daily life. So you can go on pretending they don't exist. And for us, that was a troublesome moment. We talked about it for days afterward as students. But at the community level, these things go on quite a bit. And maybe they're predominantly among people who don't have that voice or don't have the access. These groups, and I'll mention them again for the listeners, Bike DFW, as well as the Atlanta Bicycle Coalition, they have a lot of energy, a lot of connectivity. They're really robust organizations that are doing a lot for the communities. But as educators, definitely, it should be more than one plan. It should be a component of all transportation courses, because even without a formal bike lane, you will probably see a bicyclist or a wheelchair user or a pedestrian who uses that path because they have somewhere to be, just like everyone else. And it's a way of thinking, not just as motorists or as pedestrians, but also as professionals. So I'm glad to have both a practitioner and an academic here to support that, or hopefully support that thinking, that it needs to be more on everybody's mind. And we'll certainly find ways to do that. And I know I don't want to keep you too much longer. I think we've gone on for a while, and it looks like there's some very interesting things happening in the outside world as we record this. But I did want to go one more time to describe the groups. Heather's group, Bike DFW, they have a website, bikedfw.org. There's also a Twitter handle, @BikeDFW. They do a lot of outreach and workshops. If you're interested in talking about bicycle planning or education with a group that does it, sometimes with a hostile reception in North Texas, Heather has seen a lot. So check out a group like that. Also in Atlanta, the Atlanta Bicycle Coalition, they're atlantabike.org. Dr. Carrie Watkins, who works in lots of areas, not just bicycle planning. She's done a lot with technology and transit planning. You can find her on Twitter at @transitmom. And at CTED, this is a growth area for us. We have a few new projects that just started on bike planning. One is about safe routes to school. that's looking at specifically low-income school districts that are sometimes left out of the Safe Routes to School planning process. And oftentimes, it's parents and neighborhoods that organize a walking school bus or a bicycle school bus. And that project is just getting started. We don't have anything to report on it yet, but keep an eye out for that sort of thing. You can find our research at CTED, that's CTEDD, at uta.edu. We're really looking forward to this podcast going forward. I hope it's a good resource for the community as well as for scholars. And I'd especially like to thank our two guests from the first episode, Heather McNair and Dr. Carrie Watkins.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.